Welcome to Getting an Answer, the show dedicated to defending the historic Christian faith. I am your host, Harold Felder, and today the topic is Divine Intervention, the Personal Testimony of Marsha Montenegro. And that's exactly who I have on my show, Marsha Montenegro. Let me give you a little bit of a background about Marsha. Marsha has appeared on numerous broadcasts, Unshackled radio program. I've listened to that regularly. Matter of fact, I listened to it last night. Bill Bright's World Changers, Janet Parshall's America, another good show. She has also been on Christian television. Your show was actually, or your story was actually dramatized by Dr. G. James Kennedy.
That's right.
So that's pretty exciting. Mm-hmm. She graduated with honors from Florida Presbyterian College in St. Petersburg, Florida, with a degree in literature. She's pursuing a master's of art in apologetics, and she presently heads Christian Answers for the New Age. And she's also an aspiring author. So Marsha, welcome on the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Harold. It's great to be here.
Well, first of all, tell us a little bit about your ministry.
Well, my ministry, Christian Answers for the New Age, has a twofold purpose, the first of which is to educate Christians about the New Age and the occult so they can be more discerning and better equipped to witness to neighbors or friends or relatives. And the second part of the ministry is to reach out to those in the New Age and the occult, dialogue with them, present the gospel to them, and just reach them with the love and truth of Jesus Christ.
All right, that's great. Now, I also see that you're going to soon be a published author, and so your
yes.
book is coming out soon. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, this is very exciting for me. I was actually asked to write this book by Cook in Colorado Springs, and the name of the book is Spellbound, Spellbound, The Paranormal Seduction of Today's Kids. And the theme of the book is to inform particularly parents or really any adult that works with children or teenagers about the way the occult is in the culture, how it's disguised, how it's marketed, and how it's packaged, what they need to know about it to be more discerning and to be able to talk to their kids about it. So I even have in the book not just the information on it, but also suggested ways for talking to kids about it.
Okay, great. So let's talk about your testimony, because that's why we're here.
That's why we're here.
Take it away.
All right. Well, it's quite a story that is something in my life I never thought would happen. Although I grew up being exposed to church by having my mother take me and my sister to various churches as we moved around in different places, I did not know Jesus as the Savior. I just knew the stories about him, like the Sunday school stories and the Bible stories, which to me were just kind of nice stories.
Yeah.
And in high school, I had a lot of non-Christian friends. I got interested in the idea of exploring other religions, and I did start to explore them even in high school. And I decided that when I got out of high school and went to college, I was going to just explore other religions. And I made a conscious decision to reject Christianity at that point, which I saw as very outdated and narrow-minded. So in college, I did some exploration. Of course, I was busy with my college studies, but I did do some exploration. I also had some what I would call paranormal experiences, and that convinced me that there was a spiritual world out there. I was never atheistic or agnostic. I did believe that there was something spiritual there, and I wanted to access it and see what it was.
So you said you had some experiences, paranormal experiences.
Yes.
Are you gonna talk about that? Or?
Well, I could. It would take a lot of time to tell you about all of them, but
okay.
I could say I had a dream when I was 11 about a boy I had played with when I was 5, and in the dream I couldn't find him. I won't go into the details of the dream, but I woke up very frustrated, and a few months later my mother told me that she'd gotten a letter from a mutual friend who knew the family of this little boy, and the letter had the news that he had died a few months earlier of leukemia. And I realized that was around the time I had had the dream about not being able to find him. And so I put the two together and figured out I thought I'd had a dream around the time he died, that he had died, without, of course, consciously knowing about it, since
right.
he lived in another part of the world. So I had experiences like that that convinced me, what some people would call psychic experiences, that convinced me there were some kind of powers that you could learn to develop. And I was very interested in ESP. I had gotten interested in that in high school. My mother actually...
For those who are not in the know, what is ESP?
ESP, extrasensory perception. And at the time, Duke University was starting... I'm not sure when they started, but I know they were starting their whole parapsychology department. And they were exploring the use of these paranormal powers, which they call parapsychology. They don't call them psychic powers, but essentially that's what they are. And they still, I think, as far as I know, they're still doing this there. And it was kind of a big news thing then, and I was very interested. And my mother even took a course on this at the University of Maryland. We were living in Maryland at the time. And I was very interested in it. So having these paranormal experiences just convinced me that there were these kind of powers and that you could maybe access knowledge in a different way other than the normal way. Okay. So that was one interest I had, along with a developing interest in Eastern religions, which really started when I did an independent study project on Gandhi and got very interested in Gandhi's philosophy. And the whole philosophy of pacifism, I had become interested in Quaker pacifism in high school because I had a Quaker girlfriend in high school. And so all these things kind of forged together and led me on this path that just totally fascinated me. And after college, I had more time to explore, and I read books by Hans Holzer, who wrote a lot. He was kind of a ghost investigator, as he called himself, like a paranormal investigator.
Yeah.
And he wrote a lot of books on, you know, haunted houses and things like that. But he wrote them, he tried to write them in a very scientific kind of way. And I was very interested in that. And I read about past life things, reincarnation, the idea that we live many lives, we die, then we go somewhere, then we come back in another body, in another place, you know, as another person, and you keep coming back. And so I was very interested in that. And of course, that's a belief from Hinduism. Part of their religious view that you need to come back and you need to pay off your karma or your debts. You need to have the reaction to your actions from previous lives, and you have to keep doing this until you've attained enlightenment, where you transcend this worldly existence and realize your true divine nature.
Right.
So all of these things intrigued me. And after college, as I was reading these things and exploring them, I really began to take them in as my own view. And this especially started when I decided to join some groups and learn things in a more intense way rather than just reading books.
And when you say groups, what do you mean? Like a covenant or
No, I don't know. Well, different groups. For example, I was in Atlanta at the time, which is a very large city, and there's a lot of different alternative stuff going on there. The first course that I had that really had a big effect on me was called Inner Light Consciousness. It was actually hosted by Quaker House. I was going to Quaker meetings. Which is another story. I don't have time to go into it, but let me tell you this right now. It was not Christian. And they hosted this group, and this group taught Eastern meditation. They taught psychic healing, remote healing, chanting.
Psychic healing, remote healing, what are those?
Well, psychic healing would be like, you know, you're healing with your mind and with your, you know, channeling energy. And the way you do it in a remote way is that you project this onto somebody. So you imagine the person that you know is sick, and you imagine the part of them that's sick, like if they have, you know, a heart condition. So you imagine the area of their body where the heart is. And then you, through various techniques, I don't really want to explain how you do it, but because it's evil. But you visualize sending the energy to, like, the person's heart or whatever. That's called remote healing. The problem is that that's becoming accepted today, and there are even Christians who are interested in these things now. Alternative healing has been in the church for a few years, and these kind of things are actually getting in the church among born-again Christians. This is one of my big concerns.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was part of it. The big part of it, though, was every night they would lead us in a guided meditation and guided visualization where they would tell us what to see. We would fill in the details, but they would give us the big picture. And it lasted a good, 20 minutes or so, maybe even a little longer. The final night that we were doing this, they said, tonight when we do the meditation, at the end of the meditation, you are going to meet your spiritual master. And
what does that mean, your spiritual master?
Okay. Now, when they said this, they didn't really explain it except to say that the spiritual master would be our guide and would be always be there for us and would contact us and we could contact our spiritual master. They said, this is somebody that is here to guide you in this lifetime. And we all knew that this didn't mean a person was going to walk in the room. This was somebody on another plane that we were going to meet in our meditation. So we all knew that this, I don't know how other people thought of it. I just thought of it as a very advanced spiritual being who had ascended to another realm who didn't have to come back to Earth to incarnate. And that's where, when you're very, very wise and you've kind of served your time on Earth, so to speak, you can go to other realms of existence. And some people who do that choose to guide those on Earth who need spiritual guidance but who are ready for it. So they kind of like become your teacher, see, okay. Your teacher and your guide, your protector, otherwise known as a spirit guide, but they didn't call it a spirit guide. They called it a spiritual master.
Okay.
And so, at the end of the meditation, we all, they told us how to visualize it, and we all each saw our own spiritual master. And so, I saw mine, and, he looked very benevolent and wise. And
what did, could you describe him?
Yeah, kind of. He was maybe about 50-ish. He was bald. He looked kind of like Yul Brynner, the old actor from King and I. Not exactly, but kind of that kind of way. And he looked kind of Middle Eastern. And he just looked wise. I don't know how else to describe it.
And when you saw him, you said that you mean that in your mind you visualized?
I saw him in the meditation, in the guided, the guided meditation at the end. Which is when we were told, we crossed a bridge.
Did he introduce himself, or you just saw him?
No, I just saw him.
Okay.
And also, we had been prepared each night. We had been told to visualize a place where we felt really at home and really comfortable, a beautiful, peaceful place. I think this is a similar technique that they do in Silva Mind Control, because I've never had Silva Mind Control, but I read the story of someone who had it, and if I'm recalling correctly, I think one of their techniques was that they had people visualize a peaceful, beautiful place. This is very common in guided visualizations, though, so a lot of different groups and methods may use it. And like Silva Mind Control, they introduce you to your guide or different guides as well. So there's a similarity there. Now, whether these people who were doing inner light consciousness had gotten it from that, I don't know. I have no idea where they got these. They obviously got them from somewhere. They didn't make them up.
Right.
So, I felt very fortunate to have this guide, and I really did feel his presence with me. And from then on. So
he would talk to you on a regular basis? You would talk to him?
I didn't have that kind of interaction with him. A lot of people with guides have a very intense thing like that where they talk and they hear from their guides and sometimes on a daily basis, sometimes, several times a day.
Right.
I didn't have that. For whatever reason, I just felt his presence and from time to time would see him in my meditation and in my dreams.
Did he ever talk to you?
I actually don't remember him ever speaking to me. I know in one dream, he was trying to show me how to move things with my mind, but I don't remember if he was talking to me or not. There didn't seem to be a need to talk. It was like he communicated with his mind.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. That's just how my interaction was with him. And it isn't the same for everyone who has spirit guides. It seems to be very different for
everyone. Did he have a name?
And that's another thing. He never revealed his name.
Okay.
And I never asked him his name. I think because I didn't really think it was important.
Right.
And so I didn't really care what his name was.
Okay.
So I didn't ask his name. Probably if I'd wanted to know or ask, I probably would have gotten it somehow, but I didn't ever ask. But his presence was very, very real. And I definitely think that I did have this being with me, whom, of course, I believe was a demon. And, a fallen angel disguised as an angel of light.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, and I think that's what spirit guides are. They're demons.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, from that point on, things really accelerated for me on my spiritual path that I had chosen. I went to a Tibetan Buddhist group after that, and I learned how to do Tibetan Buddhist meditation, and I bought several books that they had that their leader had written, Choigam Trungpa, who I believe died in the mid-90s. I'm not sure, but at the time he was the leader of this particular Tibetan Buddhist school of learning. There's actually, everyone thinks the Dalai Lama is like the head of all Tibetan Buddhists, and that's not true. In a sense, he is, because there's actually four schools of Tibetan Buddhism, and the Dalai Lama comes from one of those four schools. But and I'm not an expert on this, but at some point they said that the head of that particular school of Tibetan Buddhism would be the head, kind of the official head of all Tibetan Buddhism, but he does not really have theological authority over the other three schools of Tibetan Buddhism. They each have their own leaders. Okay. And in this particular Tibetan Buddhist school of thought that I was involved in was not headed by the Dalai Lama. It was headed by Choigam Trungpa, who is actually, if you get into Tibetan Buddhism, he's very famous and he's very well known. So I was involved in that group, and the people in the house where I went for meditation instructions and to meditate every week. I went there every week and meditated with them. And it was open to the public, but there were people that lived there who were followers of Choigam Trungpa. And then I moved on into Zen Buddhism, and I went to some Zen Buddhist and... Now, all these people, when I say the Tibetan Buddhists and the Zen Buddhists, these were all Western people.
Okay.
They weren't from Tibet, or they weren't from Japan or whatever. They were all Westerners like me. You know, they were United States, American, you know, all American type people. I mean, right. You know what I'm saying? They weren't from other countries. They had not been raised in those religions.
Right.
They had Western backgrounds. They were Westerners. And they had
probably
adopted
some Christians
these.
In there too.
They probably a lot of them had Christian backgrounds.
Yeah,
I don't know, but I'm sure they did. And that's very common, you know, for people who get into this stuff. And so, and the Zen Buddhists was the same thing. They were all Westerners, but they had, you know, become Zen Buddhist, and some of them very seriously. And of course, their teacher, who was Western, had been in it a long time. And so I did meditation with them. I went weekly. It was usually on Sunday and Sunday morning. And I was also doing a lot of reading, and I was continuing, and I was having more and more of these paranormal experiences. In fact, I was having them on a regular basis. And
The same types, or were they different types of
experiences? Yeah, not necessarily dreams anymore so much as knowing things about people that would come to me. Now, this isn't about their future, but it's like knowing things about their past or their present, or out-of-body experiences.
When you say that you knew, what do you mean you knew? You just intuitively?
I just knew.
And...
Like, I know I met this couple that I had never met before, and as soon as I was introduced to them, I knew that the woman, even though you couldn't tell physically by looking at her, I knew she was pregnant. And about a half hour later or so, she said, oh, you know, John and I are expecting, and I didn't say anything. I was thinking in my head, though, yeah, I already knew that. But there was no way I could have rationally known that.
Yeah, and you mentioned out-of-body experiences. That fascinates me.
It does. unfortunately, you would not believe how many Christians have emailed me and talked to me personally and told me, tried to justify to me that that's a Christian thing to do. You would not believe it. I was shocked at first to come across Christians who actually either had done it and wanted to keep doing it or wanted to justify a desire to try to do it. And it's extremely evil. There's nothing biblical about it. They always use the thing in Corinthians where Paul says he was taken, where he says he was taken to the third heaven.
Right.
And he said, but he says, whether I was in the body or out, I do not know. So
right.
for he doesn't say, he doesn't know how he got to the third heaven. And he's not allowed to reveal anything that God showed him. And this was clearly something initiated by the Lord.
Yeah.
Paul didn't initiate it.
Right.
He didn't practice an out-of-body technique to
right.
go to the third heaven. But there are Christians who want to learn techniques to do this. And here's my thing, is I don't know if you can really go out of the body or not. It might just all be a big delusion.
Right.
But I can tell you that when you do it, it seems very real. And the thing is that when it happened to me, it actually happened to me in college for the first time, and I didn't know what it was. I had never heard of out-of-body things. Or astral travel. I had never heard of that at that point. And I actually thought I had died, you know, because I saw my body on the bed and I was on the ceiling. So I thought I had died. And I didn't tell anybody about it. I didn't know what it was. But several years later, well, actually not that long after that, a few years later, I started having those experiences on an ongoing basis. And I think at that point I had read about out-of-body or had heard about it somewhere. So at that point I knew what it was. I can't remember when I learned about it. And, of course, I saw it as a spiritual experience and that you could go to other dimensions and other levels of reality. But the thing is that a lot of these experiences were not, there was nothing spiritual about them. And there was nothing really, there's nothing good. You know, they're just these sensations of being sucked out of your body and going out somewhere like into outer space, and you don't know where you are or where you're going or what you're doing there. Or, I mean, it's just, and sometimes you see weird stuff, you know. It's really bizarre. It's very bizarre. And I really don't like to talk about it too much because I don't like to get people interested in the sensational
okay,
side
enough.
Of things.
Okay,
yeah.
I
people get to get a morbid fascination with this stuff. So
yeah.
I usually don't talk about it.
Okay. All right.
And if they ask me, I'll say something brief, but I don't like to go into it.
Yeah.
And I find it extremely repulsive to talk about because
okay.
I know that it's evil.
Right.
Okay. So moving right along. So I continued on this path, and I decided that I really wanted to specifically develop some abilities that I could use to help people. Instead of just being a student, I wanted to do something more practical for people. And so I took two classes. I signed up for two classes at the same time. One was psychic development and one was astrology. And I'd always been interested in astrology. And so I started studying those. And, of course, in the psychic development class, I started having more of the psychic stuff going on. But I loved astrology. And I had one of the astrology teachers there encouraged me to take the astrology exam in the city of Atlanta. They actually give you an exam. And this was set up several years earlier by the astrologers in Atlanta and by the city council. And they did it in order to keep the scam artists out of astrology. So, in other words, you would have to take a test to prove you really knew astrology. You couldn't just sit there and make stuff up. And so
so astrology is a science.
Astrology isn't really a science. It's a pseudoscience, but it's very, very, like all forms of the occult, it's very complex.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually very difficult. And I'm not trying to say that to say, oh, you know, I'm so smart because I study astrology. But it's actually very complicated. And not really, maybe difficult isn't the right word, but it's complex. It's because you have to, the astrologer is looking at the chart, which is a picture of the planets at the time of your birth. And it's in a circle. It's in a 360-degree circle. And there's 12 signs of the zodiac around the circle according to what time you were born. And so the 12 houses will rotate. They rotate around the whole circle. Well, the planets rotate around the whole circle in the 24 hours. So it's constantly shifting. And what the astrologer is looking at is the planets, what houses they're in, what sign they're in, what sign is on each, what sign of the zodiac is on each house, the distance of the planets from each other. That all means something. If a planet is opposite another planet, that means something. If a planet is 90 degrees from another planet, that means something. If a planet is next to another planet, that means something. 60 degrees means something. 30 degrees means something. There's all these different angles, you know, of distance that mean something. And so the astrologer's interpreting that. They're interpreting the ruling planets. They're looking at, you know, if you have Mars on the ascendant, on the rising sign, which is the eastern horizon, you know, then, and Mars rules Aries, so then maybe you have another planet in Aries, and there's a connection between that. There's just all these connections. I mean, there's thousands of connections in the chart. So the astrologer's putting all, synthesizing all this when they're giving the reading, so that you're not just giving choppy little pieces of information. You have to synthesize it into a meaningful pattern for the person.
Okay.
And it takes a lot of practice. I mean, I, you know, practiced on people before I did it professionally. So anyway, I did take the exam and I passed, and I purchased a license, which was a legal requirement if you lived in the city limits, which I did. And I started, you know, practicing professionally that was in 1983. And I eventually was on the Board of Astrology Examiners. And the Board of Astrology Examiners is the board set up by the city that formulates and grades the exams. The exams are actually given in City Hall. And the board, but the board is are the astrologers who formulate and grade the exam, because obviously people at City Hall can't grade an astrology exam.
Right.
So the board, so basically, even though you're certified by the city, it's really the board that's certifying you.
Okay.
So they're just saying that, yes, you passed, you know enough to pass the astrology exam. And I was on that board for 4 years. I was chairperson for 3 years. And then in June 1989, I became president of the Astrological Society. And I also want to add that starting around the time, even shortly before I took the astrology classes, I had been reading a lot of books like Be Here Now by Ram Dass and Seth Speaks, which is a books by Jane Roberts, that she claimed she was channeling an entity named Seth. And other books like that, The Tao of Physics. Well, actually, I had read that a few years earlier. And all of these books served to change my worldview, so that my view of reality had shifted dramatically since I had been in high school and even college. So that the way I saw reality was completely different from the way most people see reality. Mm. Or at least at the time, most people. I think that that's changing now. Unfortunately, New Age is mainstream now. So my worldview was completely different at that time. And as I did astrology, which I loved, you know, I saw everything astrologically, analyzed everything through astrology. That was just kind of my whole life was focused on that, except for my son. I had married and had a son. But in 1989, my marriage came to an end. One of my clients actually offered me a part-time job in his office to give him astrological advice on the employees. and he offered me a lot more money than I'd ever made. So I, of course, took the job because I was a single parent and I needed the money. And I could still do my astrology.
Right.
So it was ideal. So it was great. So I was doing that, and I was very hostile to Christianity. I never went to church unless it was, you know, maybe once in a great while, you know, a marriage or a funeral or something.
And why were you so hostile toward Christianity?
You know, my hostility grew. It just grew and grew and grew from the time I had left high school. I thought Christians were very judgmental and narrow-minded. And I thought that, you know, they were condemning me. And actually, a few did. Unfortunately, I had some negative encounters. So my opinion of them was very, very low. And I didn't want anything to do with them. I mean, I was at the point where I didn't even want to talk to a Christian. you know, and I did meet a couple here and there. I was doing some temp jobs for a while when I'd been married, and I ran into a couple, but they'd never tried to preach to me or anything. But that's what I was always afraid of. I was always afraid if someone was going to tell me astrology was evil and, you know, I shouldn't be doing it and I needed Jesus or something like that. And I was extremely defensive. And that, and you can, you know, and I don't know why I was like that. You could say maybe there was a conviction there of sin that I didn't want to acknowledge.
Yeah.
That's possible. But I don't know for sure. And so I was very hostile. And so I was very surprised in the spring of 1990 when I got a compulsion to go to a church. And I just, you know, I didn't understand what this was, and I didn't want to go, and I resisted it. And it continued through the spring and the summer. And in fact, that August, I went to an astrological conference in Eugene, Oregon. I was writing for a magazine that was published there, and the publisher had a conference. He'd had one in 1988, and I had gone to that. And he had another one in 90, and I went there, and I did workshops. And I came back, and I thought the compulsion would be gone, but it wasn't. It was still there. And I thought, you know, I'm just going to go and get this out of my system, because it's probably from a previous life and, you know, one of my previous Christian lives, and, you know, I probably need to confront something, or I don't know. You know, that's how I rationalize it. So I went to the church. I sat in the back on the end because I was planning to leave early. Well, the service began. They played music. Everyone stood up. The ministers in the choir came from the back of the church and walked down the center aisle, and they were led by a young boy with a cross. This was a church with kind of a formal liturgy. And the young boy had a cross, and as he walked by me, I felt this overwhelming love falling down on me, and I knew it was from a personal God. I mean, it was just very clear to me. This was a personal God telling me that he loved me. And I did, but I didn't understand why it was happening or what it meant. And I was sort of overwhelmed by it, and I was crying. And I had been planning to leave early, but I stayed for the whole service. And then I decided to come back the next Sunday. So I came back, and I kept coming back every Sunday. And you know, each Sunday that I came back, I was more and more, I more and more wanted to be there in that church. But I want to point out, it was a very, very open-minded church, and I was not getting any flack for being an astrologer. So I was very comfortable there. But there was also something about it that I liked, but I didn't know what it was. And so within a few weeks, I started getting this impression that God didn't like astrology. And I couldn't understand why God wouldn't like astrology. I didn't understand why he wouldn't like it, because I thought I was helping people with it. And in a few weeks after that, I mean, very quickly after that, I got an impression God wanted me to stop doing it. And I just was blown away, because I thought, there's no way I can give up astrology. You know, it's like my lifeblood, and how could I possibly give it up? You know, God's gone too far asking me to give it up. But it was very clear to me that he wanted me to give it up. And I was becoming uncomfortable with some things that normally I was comfortable with. That was going on at the same time. But I did not understand any of this. I did not have a clue as to what was happening. I was totally, totally clueless. And yet, I made the decision the night before Thanksgiving. Now, I had gone to the church on Labor Day weekend. Okay. Now, it's the night before Thanksgiving of 1990.
Okay.
I make the decision to give astrology up. And I actually follow through on it within a few weeks. And I start reading the Bible. I decide, okay, I am going to start reading the Bible. I didn't know why, but I did. And I started reading Matthew, and I'm reading a little bit every night in Matthew in December. And shortly before Christmas, while I'm reading a passage in Matthew 8, I'm reading that passage, and I'm reading it over and over, And God just opened my eyes and I saw Jesus and I saw who he was. I realized he was the Savior. He was, the Son of God, that he had died for me, and that I needed to be reconciled with God. I realized that up to that point in my life, I had been on a path that was leading away from God.
What passage was that in Matthew 8?
It was the passage where Jesus rebukes the sea and the wind, the storm, with the disciples who are scared, and they think, he's asleep, and they wake him up. And he rebukes the sea and the wind. Well, that was the passage. And, and there's nothing magical about that passage. You know, I don't want people to think, well, if I use that passage on my New Age friend, they'll see who Jesus is. You know, it was the Word of God. It was the power of God, of the Word of God. And any passage in the Bible can open people's eyes to the truth, because I've heard other testimonies of people being saved reading other passages in the Bible. But God used that passage for me. And I don't know, but he did. And it was really, I just saw Jesus clearly, and I saw him for who he was. And
I was reading your biography on your website, and I was reading that when you were talking about that passage, and one of the things you said was, one of the things that caught your attention about that passage was that Jesus was not someone who was learning how to manipulate the forces. He actually rebuked.
Right. He had authority.
Right. He had authority, of which is so different than what you were experiencing.
Right. That's true. Right. That's true. He did. He had authority. He didn't use a technique.
Right.
Or anything like that. He had authority over nature.
Right.
And that's right. That was something very striking about that passage.
Yeah.
And then he says to the disciples, you have little faith. You know, where is your faith? You know, and that struck me too, because the thing about that, and this sounds weird, but what really struck me about that statement from Jesus was how much love there was in it. Because even though it was a reprimand, he had saved them from the storm. You know, despite their lack of faith, he saved them.
Right.
And that to me was such a loving act. And so the love, what really came through for me was the love of Christ.
Right.
Just like what got me in the beginning was God's love coming down on me. I think it's because it's something I didn't really know about, and I had never experienced, and perhaps never been told about.
Yeah.
I don't remember thinking about God's love for me, you know, except in maybe a very superficial way, but I never understood it. Of course, you know, I had to realize that I was wrong too. I had been on a path that was completely against God. So it was at the same, it was simultaneous.
Right.
And I just turned my life over to Jesus at that moment, and I knew right away that I was a different person.
Right.
And my life, of course, changed dramatically. I didn't have anything in common with my friends anymore, so I lost, lost all my friends, which was hard at that age. I mean, I wasn't young when this happened. My son was 9 years old. And I had not had him early in life. I'm not going to say how old I was, but I wasn't what anyone would call a young age, and or even close to being young. And it's very hard to lose your friends at that time of your life. And it was a very difficult time, in the sense that I really didn't understand what was going on, and I didn't have anyone to disciple me. And I was in a church where they didn't even understand what had happened to me, where some people thought what I was saying was strange.
Right.
You know, like people didn't understand why I had stopped doing astrology. And they didn't understand when I told them I had fallen in love with Jesus, which is something I said to this Bible study group I was with. I don't know if Bible study is the right word for it, but I was in this group that met with the rector of the parish or the rector of the church. And he was taking us through Mark. And I think at that point it had switched to another, because he had to leave and they got another priest. And I can't remember now who was there at the time. But people didn't really understand what had happened to me. And eventually I did leave. I had to leave that church. But what this is the thing that's really important for people to know. In that office where I had been working, of course, I had to tell my boss I couldn't, do any more astrology. But he kept me on and just gave me busy work. And so I was still there in April of 91. And at that point, this there's this young Christian man in the office. And I was having a conversation with him. And I had told him back in January that I had given astrology up and become a Christian. And he hadn't said anything. Now, I knew he was a Christian, you know. And he was the only one in the office that I knew was a Christian. An office of 40 people. And looking back now, I think there might have been a couple of other people, but I think there were only two or three real believers in that office. You know, I don't know for sure, but that's my memory of it. And he hadn't really said anything. He had just kind of smiled. But in April, I said, you know, it's so strange that a few months ago I was an astrologer and now I'm a Christian. And I said, it's just so strange to me. It's so hard for me to believe this. And he said, maybe somebody was praying for you. And I said, oh, no, I don't know anybody who would be praying for me. And I kind of saw this little smile on his face. And I said, oh, wait a minute. I said, were you praying for me? And he said, well, actually, he said, my fellowship group at my church was praying for you.
Wow.
So they had been praying for me all during 1990 when all those things happened.
Wow.
They were praying faithfully.
So the minute that you got there and were doing this astrological, all these readings and stuff, he recognized that, saw that, and started praying for you. His group started praying for you.
Yeah. They did not. Now, no one at the office knew that's why I was there, because it was
okay.
A secret. Oh,
okay.
Yeah, because that would have been against the law.
Okay.
Nobody at that office, that's why I'm not going to say where I was working, but because the man who hired me isn't there anymore, but, you know, somebody could find out who he was, and he'd get in trouble, which, you know, this was a long time ago, but...
Right.
No one knew that was why I was there, but they knew I did let people know I was an astrologer.
Okay.
And so he knew I was an astrologer. And he had befriended me. He didn't keep his distance. He had befriended me. He would come up and, you know, talk to me and chat with me and ask me what I thought about things. You know, he never preached at me. Never invited me to church. Now, I think it's because, you know, he could tell my hostility.
Okay.
And he didn't want to put me on the defensive because that would have just made me angry and push me away. So he never said anything to me that would have put me on the defensive.
Right.
He was just gracious and nice. He was, you know, this young, you know, he's about 30, maybe 32 or something. I'm not sure how old he was, but he was just this nice young man. And I saw him, I knew he was a Christian, and I saw him, you know, as a very nice person. I liked him. And because he was a nice guy. And all that time, he'd been praying for me at a fellowship group at his church.
Marsha, tell us now, what's different in your life now than it was before? What is the most glaring difference in your life now?
The most glaring thing to me, spiritually speaking, is that before, you're constantly searching. The New Agers love to say they're on a journey because they really are. Unfortunately, it's a futile journey unless God intervenes. But they're on a journey. They're looking here. They're looking there. They're going to this workshop. They're going to that teacher. They're reading this book. They're reading that book. You know, Zen Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, you know, all these different areas that you can go into. And astrology. And there's always seeking because there's never any final answer there. But in Christ is the answer.
Right.
You don't have to figure out the answer. Right. You don't have to have an experience to get the answer. Christ is the answer. He right. is the answer. He's the answer, and he's the rock.
Right.
And so I'm not floating around on this journey anymore. I'm anchored to a rock, which is Jesus Christ. And even though we still continue to on a journey in the sense of growing in Christ, it's not because we're looking for an answer.
Okay.
We have the answer already.
Okay.
And that, to me, is the biggest difference.
All right. On that note, Marsha, we're going to end this episode
okay.
of Giving an Ass. I've been talking with Marsha Montenegro. We've been talking about her spiritual journey from the occult, from New Age to Christ. So that will end this episode of Giving an Answer. Be sure to join me again next time. And until then, goodbye and God bless. You can contact Giving an Answer by visiting us on the web at www.givinganswer.org, or you can call us at 704-248-7840. You can also contact us via mail at Giving an Answer, P.O. Box 1972, Matthews, North Carolina, zip code 28106.
For the hope that lies in you.